From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on the evening of February 26th in Fairport. More than 1,000 people, including many teachers and parents, rallied against Governor Cuomo's plans to reform education in New York State. They called the governor's plan an attack on public schools, particularly an insult to hardworking teachers. Now, the governor has fired back, arguing that it is simply too difficult to get rid of bad teachers, that there needs to be more accountability and better results. For months, I've hoped that the governor or his staff would take us up on our invitations to come on this program. In the meantime, we've had no shortage of conversations with teachers, parents, and superintendents who oppose the governor's plan. This hour, we'll welcome some pro-reform voices on Connections. Let me begin by saying that whenever we talk about education, someone in our listening audience accuses me of an agenda, of not trying to hear another side, of ignoring certain voices. And I hope I've shown that's not the case. But it's also true that until now, it has been more difficult to line up the pro-reform voices. So this hour, we're going to hear from them. Next hour, next time we get together, we're going to try to convene a studio panel filled with voices on all sides. Hope to do that next week. But for now, let me welcome the panel. And as always, your phone calls will be welcome. Carrie Remus is a parent. She served as a member of the Governor's Education Reform Commission back in 2012, 2013. And she was a member of Mayor Lovely Warren's 2014 Early Learning Council. Welcome, Carrie. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All of those things are accurate. You're also a former Administrator. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a director of admissions at the Warner School of Education.
Very good.
I recruited teachers and principals.
All right, very good. Thanks for being here, Carrie. Jeff Spink's here. He's an education consultant based in Rochester. He has worked as an education lobbyist in Washington, and he was also on Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren's Early Learning Council in 2014. Jeff, thanks for being here. And also here is Justin Kwasa, and Justin is Rochester and Central New York Advocacy Manager at the Northeast Charter Schools Network. Justin, thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let me start by looking at what the governor wants to do, and then we'll talk about what our panel supports, what you don't support, or what you'd like to see change. So the governor's proposal, 50% of a teacher's evaluation would come from students' state test scores or in non-tested grades, a student growth measure calculating 1 year of academic growth. 35% would come from independent observations, the remaining 15% from supervisor observations. And the governor has called the current teacher evaluation system baloney. My understanding is he's also interested in seeing the state expand what is available in terms of charter schools. But let me just kind of go around the table, and I'll start with Carrie. He's talking about teacher evaluations, and he wants more accountability. Is he right?
I think he's right. I think the governor's proposal is attempting to correct some of the unintended consequences of the 2012 APPR. There was in some districts, there was over-testing that was a result of the local assessment portion of that original formula. That's gone. So if you're a parent and you're concerned about over-testing in your district, that's not going to be an issue anymore. There's no new testing. And also aimed to address the unintended consequence of sort of the inflation that we saw in some of the calculations in some of the districts that resulted in 97% of the teachers being effective. I'm not sure I support the outside evaluators. Mm-hmm. I think that I think it dilutes the principal's authority, but it's certainly not a done deal yet. They're negotiating it as we speak. So,
not too much emphasis on test scores.
My daughter's a junior right now, and sort of looking back on our years in public ed, there wasn't a moment when I didn't have to intervene in my daughter's academic life where I didn't use test scores to make my case for something, whether it was acceleration or some sort of intervention. So I'm not opposed to test scores. I think it's important that we hold our building leaders accountable for keeping the learning climate focused on learning and not focused on test prep. But that's a different issue.
Okay. But do you agree with his premise that it's too difficult to get rid of ineffective teachers?
I do.
Okay. Jeff, let me turn to you. Again, your work as an educational consultant has spanned many different communities in this country. What the governor's trying to do, how much do you look at that and say, yes, this is what we need here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, without going into the details, I think the urgency that he's showing to address some of these things is right on. I think, you know, as Carrie mentioned, when you look at the teacher evaluation piece, you know, this notion of having, you know, a very high number of teachers rated effective, and then you look at some of the test scores, mm-hmm. you know, looking here in Rochester City School District where you have, you know, 5% of kids proficient in reading, you know, can understand that disconnect and why the governor wants to address that. So, you know, I think he's on the right track. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that I really wanted to talk about and address is this narrative that's out there that we've heard from Fairport, which I should say I'm a Fairport grad. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested to hear, you know, some of the things coming out of there. And it's really this notion of, you know, the reform movement of being focused on destroying public education mm-hmm. and privatization and some of the things that have been mentioned, and just drawing on, you know, some of the work I've done. You mentioned the work in Washington as a lobbyist, and I worked on the No Child Left Behind Act, which most people are probably familiar with. It wasn't the most popular bill in the world, but you know, there's just a disconnect there. Having worked on that, the primary supporters of that law were Senator Ted Kennedy, Representative George Miller, who is a liberal Democrat from San Francisco, and then really a lot of civil rights organizations across the country, and the major ones. We're talking the NAACP, ACLU, all those organizations.
The complaints I've heard, Jeff, are that NCLB was okay, that it was underfunded after it was passed. I don't know if that's accurate. I mean, the legislation is somewhat dated in my mind now, mm-hmm. but I don't know if that's accurate.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly concerns that it was underfunded. There was, you know, major increases in funding as well, but there's also, in a lot of ways, that set the stage for the conversations we're having now, particularly that emphasis on testing. And just going back to that point, the civil rights groups were so focused on that because poor minority and special ed kids in the past were not being counted effectively. And so that's the focus that No Child Left Behind did and subsequent efforts on reform have done. So I just want to, you know, push back a little on this notion that it's all about privatization, it's all about, you know, this corporate agenda, mm-hmm. When really it's a civil rights issue that's driving a lot of it.
Before I kick it over to Justin, I want to follow up on one point. You make the point that when you look at proficiency, mm-hmm. we can look at graduation rates in Rochester. We know that they are dismal.
Yep.
We know that proficiency tends to be a big, big problem. Yeah. And then some people, the governor included, look at that and say, how can you have low graduation rates, proficiency really struggling, but 97% of teachers are effective? Yeah. Isn't it, just as a thought experiment, let's say we all agree on whatever metric you want to use, we all agree on the 100 best teachers you've ever met, and you put them in a school district, mm-hmm. and if half the kids don't show up, you're not going to tell the teachers are suddenly bad teachers, are they? Yeah. I mean, you're going to have graduation rates go down. You're mm-hmm. going to have some students suffering, problems at home, nutritional issues. Yeah. Are the teachers to blame for that?
No, the teachers aren't to blame for that. And that is, you know, and there's, so, you know, getting back to, I think, to another point is this sort of, we also get into this either or conversation, right? So it's either just about school or it's what happens outside of school. I feel very strongly that it's both, right? And so we need to address what happens outside of school and whether that's attendance, which is a huge issue. I would put, you know, I think parents have a role in that, but I'd say schools have a role in that and making school a place where kids want to be and it's engaging. And I think that'll help, that can help with attendance and those outside factors. But yeah, I mean, we're not saying, and I'm not saying, and I don't think anyone here is, I think the larger point you're sort of making here is around poverty and that role. And it's, again, it's not an either or. We need to think it needs to be, you need to address poverty, you need to address it outside of school, but you also need to address what's happening in school as well.
Okay. And Carrie's recently wrote an op-ed in the Democrat and Chronicle that touched on this and some other things. And I don't want to read too much into what you wrote, Carrie. I would encourage our listeners to check it out in the Democrat and Chronicle. But it sounds to me like what you guys are saying is, yes, poverty is an issue, but you cannot use it as an excuse.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a fair point? Okay.
Fair point. Yep.
Let me turn it over to Justin then, because when we look at what the governor is also talking about is when you look at charter schools, it is polarizing to some people.
Absolutely.
First of all, why are charter schools still polarizing?
I don't want to put words in other people's mouths. One of the things I was really encouraged the governor to do, and we're really supportive of the governor doing, is increasing choice. You know, a lot of communities, parents don't have the option to move to another place or to enroll in a private school. So there need to be public school options that are available to them where they are. And so charter schools provide that. And we definitely encourage the governor, and we're definitely happy that the governor supports creating those options, and in addition, to support those schools. So, for instance, the governor wants to increase the amount of per pupil that charter schools get by $75. That's really great because charter schools, as you may know, are very much underfunded. A Rochester City charter school student gets paid 68 cent to what a Rochester City school district student gets paid. That's not fair for the same student. So, you know, we just very much encourage the fact that choice is available to parents regardless of where they are, whether they're in Fairport or in the city of Rochester.
Until the last 15 months, I've never tried to look on my own in terms of research just to ask basic questions, such as, is there evidence that shows charter schools have better outcomes? And so I've struggled to find, sometimes you're looking at things and you're not sure they're apples to apples in the world of charter schools. Mm-hmm. For example, New Orleans is now something along the lines of 90% of public school students are going to charter schools. And I think something like 78 to 80% of the schools in New Orleans are now charter schools. Do we look at New Orleans, for example, and say, hey, that'll be a good model to understand what's possible? Or is it apples to oranges to you?
I think one thing with charters is, and that's great about charters, is they adjust to whatever situation they're in. So what looks right in Rochester may not necessarily look good in New Orleans. So you need to look at it case-by-case basis. I think that goes also with the schools themselves. There are various schools that cater to different parts of the educational experience. I think that one thing that we do know is that there is a demand for charter schools based on wait lists. And so parents want to get into charters. Parents want that option. And so I think as long as there's demand that we need to, as best as we can, help provide that.
All right. So listeners, you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I know our panel has heard again in the last month or so on this program and elsewhere, people like Fairport Superintendent Bill Calla and others defending teachers, saying that a lot of what is being discussed is unfair to teachers or insulting to teachers. A number of former Teachers of the Year in New York State, including Rich Onyebene, who is a teacher in Fairport, wrote a letter to the governor saying that they were insulted by the approach and some of the rhetoric. I want to listen to some of Bill Calla's comments from a month ago on this program and then let our panel respond to some of the points he's making. So first, let's listen to Bill Calla. He's defending teachers in this comment.
I think it's insulting to hear that the governor say that this is about students, because this is not about students. This is about crushing a teacher's union. And this is from someone who's never paid a union due in his life. The whole issue of teacher tenure is a bogus issue. We have 3 years to determine whether or not a teacher is satisfactory or not. And I can tell you from being in education for 44 years, I know after the first month whether or not a teacher is good or not. And what the governor apparently doesn't know is the teachers who are counseled out by the droves before that time. So we have a really outstanding teacher corps in this state. The issue is not teacher quality. We know for a fact through the research that the social constructs are over 60% of determining whether or not a student is going to do well in school. We know that the teacher quality is anywhere from 10 to 20%.
10 to 20%. Carrie, do you accept that estimate that Bill Calla is offering, that social is 60% or more, teachers make an impact, but only 10 to 20%?
You know, I don't know if I would agree with him. I will say that of all the school-based factors, effective teaching matters most. What he hasn't said about the research is that we know now that the poor children are more likely to have an ineffective teacher, more likely to have an unqualified teacher, more likely to have an inexperienced teacher. So we have to develop policy tools to get at that problem, that double standard. And the other thing I would say in response to his comment is, you know, this counseling out practice, that, and you hear this a lot from suburban mm-hmm. superintendents, mm-hmm. these people that are counseled out, they go someplace else to teach. They go to poor districts to teach. They're not leaving the profession necessarily.
All right. So when Bill Calla is saying they're very good at identifying teachers who shouldn't get tenure, that doesn't mean they're leaving the practice
entirely.
That's
right. It means they're not in the affluent suburbs.
But Bill Calla may say other districts, that he's not only speaking for Fairport, that districts do a good job generally of sussing out who is going to be effective or not before anybody gets tenure in Fairport or anywhere else.
I don't believe there's any data that supports that. The unsuccessful teachers in the affluent suburbs get counseled out and get sent to the city.
All right. I have one other comment from Superintendent Keld that dovetails exactly on the point that Carrie's making. Now, Carrie is saying, you know, look here. We know from data that kids in poverty are more likely to have ineffective teachers. And Bill Calla would likely tell you that's a chicken and egg problem. Let's listen to Bill Calla talking about one specific case of a teacher and the ratings. Let's listen.
Recently, it was made aware of a teacher, and it was published as well. A teacher from Brooklyn, who last year had 50% of his students fail. He was labeled a failing teacher in the evaluation system. He moved from Brooklyn to a suburban school. 98% of his kids passed. He's now highly effective. And his own comments were, what did I do differently from last year to this? He moved from school to school. So we know, geography has an awful lot to play in this, in the whole scheme of whether or not kids do well.
All right, so in other words, is it that kids in poverty are likely to have ineffective teachers, or is it that teachers are likely to be labeled more ineffective if they are predominantly teaching kids in poverty?
I think one thing that I would say, that it's important to understand that the teacher evaluation tool is not completely uniform from district to district. So Dr. Kale is making an apples to oranges comparison. That's just, it's not really that meaningful, because the second district that the teacher moved to is a different tool, a different evaluation tool. So,
okay, Jeff?
I mean, I would just add, I think I can under that. You know, I would agree it's probably more difficult to teach in an urban environment, mm-hmm. right? But those are the kids that you're, as a teacher, you get the kids that you have. So, you know, I think in some ways it requires, extra work and extra effort to make progress with those kids. So, that, those numbers don't necessarily surprise me, that Bill Cal is using there. Just to get back to the other point about this idea about crushing unions and that sort of rhetoric. Again, I think you have to go back to where a lot of these reforms came from, and the focus, again, was on making sure that poor, minority, and special education students were counted and that schools were held accountable for them. That's the focus. That's why a lot of these reforms are in place. And interestingly, I previously worked for the governor of Pennsylvania and did a lot of work with districts around the state. And similar to here in New York, most of the pushback, if not all the pushback we got about accountability, was from high-performing suburban districts, mm-hmm. similar to Fairport. You don't hear a lot of pushback here in New York, and we didn't in Pennsylvania, from the urban districts.
All right, before I get to the phones, help me understand the landscape as you see it then, when it comes to especially urban districts, Rochester chief among them. What is it about districts that you think, why are they doing a poor job in hiring teachers? Is it that there aren't a lot of good teachers available, or that they simply are making a bad management decision, Jeff?
I don't know the answer.
But it's got to be one or the other, right?
I think it is a difficult job teaching in the city. I do agree that poverty does, all the things that we've talked about, makes it a more difficult job. I think if everyone had the answer as to why we have the stats in Rochester, we would have fixed it by now. I don't know the answer to that. We do know, partly because of accountability, we know what the numbers are, and we know that they're not anywhere where they need to be. I will say, it's not all on teachers. I mean, it's everything. It's the community. It's not this either or situation. So everything matters. I think the teaching is a piece of it. It's not solely to blame, though.
Okay. But as Carrie said, you think it's the most important factor within a school environment, right?
Absolutely.
So do you think that, for example, Rochester as a district is simply doing a poor job of evaluating teachers, or the pool is just not talented enough in your mind that's coming into the city willing to teach?
I can't really answer that. I will say, though, that there are some differences in contracts between the city and the suburbs. Mm-hmm. It takes longer for large districts to work through their voluntary transfer process, so they tend to be hiring later in the season than the suburban districts do. So, that has some impact on which candidates they can pick from to start. Van White tried to address that to some degree a few years ago. I don't think it's been particularly successful.
Okay. We've got a listener comment I'm going to get to on charter schools. In fact, as I see the phone start to ring again, 844-295-TALK. Let me get Jake's comment, and it's on charter schools, and I'll direct it to Justin here. He says, the original goal of charter schools, as I understand it, was to find what works and then apply it to the larger public school system. Is that accurate, and why does that not seem to happen? Because Jake says what charter schools seem to end up doing is siphoning off the most promising of the main public system. There's a couple points there. First of all, is his premise correct? Was the original point of charter schools to find what works and then apply it more largely, more broadly to the public system?
Absolutely, yeah. When the first Charter School Act was passed, it was very much done with the support of the teachers' union, with the support of the district, because, yes, they're supposed to be laboratories, for lack of a better term, for, you know, schools to have autonomy to kind of do whatever they want to do, figure out what are the best practices, and then apply them back to the district so they can help everybody. Unfortunately, that's something that hasn't necessarily happened as much as we'd like to see in Rochester. But there have been different agendas to help bring that. So about 4 years ago, there was a district charter compact that was signed by the district and some of the charter leaders. That was never quite followed through to fidelity, mainly because of Jean-Claude Bizard. He found his way out of town, and that never went through there. And there are also a couple of other ways. Times where the Board of Education could have worked with charters to share some best practices, but due to
give me an example then.
What's something that could be done
To make the system better, to make that charter mission more in reality, carrying out what the idea was?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, it's just a matter of a willingness from the district to just sit down. Let's start having conversation. It doesn't have to be necessarily huge things, but with certain people, they just don't necessarily want to have that conversation, just because this issue has been so polarized, and there are so many other things that have gotten in to this issue that have nothing to do with the actual education that take the two sides far apart.
Now, let me get to our first phone call is on that same subject that Jake wanted to bring up. This is Dorothy, wants to talk about charter schools. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Hello. I was calling, I think Jake mentioned this, but that our student pool is sort of like the insurance pool, and there's been a lot of talk with the current healthcare plan, how if healthy kids or healthy people aren't buying insurance, how it can't work. Our public schools are like that, that if all the kids who have active parents who are going to succeed in their education anyway because they have involved parents, their parents are looking out for them, they're looking for the best education opportunities, and they may choose a charter school, those kids are going to succeed no matter what school they're in. But what's going to be left in the public schools, minus the money that would be with the kids that are in the charter schools, are the kids with the most need. And I guess I'd like an answer from, is that true? Are charter schools reaching out for kids who have higher needs? And that correlates to a lot of, this is a discussion on charter schools, but it seems like there's been a lot of discussion on the teacher evaluations. How can we, just like the guy from Brooklyn, I think a lot of highly driven teachers search out to work in the Rochester City School District. If you're motivated, you want to go to where you can do the most good. Also, Rochester pays higher for starting teachers. I've heard a couple people who have graduated with teaching degrees, and they wait, they take sub jobs, and after 2 or 3 years, they're like, okay, I'll try one of the suburbs because I haven't gotten a full-time position at Rochester.
All right, well, Dorothy,
those would be two comments.
Yeah, thanks for the call. You've given us a lot to think about there. Justin's going to answer first. He's the Rochester and Central New York Advocacy Manager at the Northeast Charter Schools Network. Go ahead.
All right. First of all, that was a lot of questions. So I would yes. try my best to remember everything that was mentioned. The one thing I will say about charter schools is charter schools would not exist unless there was a want for another option. For as long as we can remember, there's always been the Rochester City School District. And at some point, the parents and members of the community said, we need something different. So you said, people always want to say that charter schools siphon off or they only take the best. Those students were originally in the Rochester City School Districts, and it wasn't working for them. So we also need to determine why wasn't it working for them in the Rochester City School Districts. And then they came up to the charters where all of a sudden now results are being gotten. So I think that's a question we also need to ask when we have the charter school debate. The last thing I'll say, as I said, it was a lot of questions. charter schools, because they have the autonomy to kind of innovate and do what they want, they aren't necessarily beholden to the same evaluation standards for teachers as the district schools are. And so that's why you don't necessarily hear charter schools in the debate when it comes to teacher evaluations.
As I understand it, and Justin, tell me if I'm wrong here. Again, what the governor wants to do, we've been talking about teacher evaluations as one prong, but he also wants to add 100 charter schools to the state limit, bringing the total to 560, and he would remove the regional distinctions that restricted some charters to New York City and other parts of the state where there was less demand. Is that also, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Right. So we'd see more allowance for charters. And polling is very interesting on this. People are pointing to a couple new polls, but the new polls are sort of against Cuomo on the rhetoric of the debate, but pro-charter. Let me read for what we're seeing today. Here's the headline in the Syracuse Post-Standard this morning. Fight with teachers pushes Cuomo's approval to all-time low. His approval rating is now 50%, down from 58% in just December. And the poll found that voters don't want teachers paid based on student test scores. That's 71 to 25. They trust teachers' unions more than the governor, 55 to 28. But voters favor an expansion of charter schools, 50 to 41. Any of that contradictory, Carrie, any of that contradictory to you, or what do you make of those numbers?
I think we have to separate personality from policy, right? The public likes charter policy. And, you know, some of the governor's rhetoric has been offensive to some members of the public. Let's focus on the policy.
So you're saying it's no surprise that the governor is losing the personality fight. But on the policy, you're not surprised at some of this.
Right, and we should judge him on policy, not on his personality.
All right, I've got to get a 60-second break in. The phones are lit up. We're going to take more of your calls. We've been talking about what our panel, a pro-reform panel today, thinks about the governor's plans. But let's get outside of that. Let's ask them, especially someone like Jeff, who's worked in educational consulting around the country. What else can be done here? What is in play? What's possible that you would think would lead to better outcomes? Your comments and their comments as well as we continue on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking to Justin Kwasa from the Northeast Charter Schools Network. Carrie Remus is a parent and served as a member of the Governor's Education Reform Commission in 2012 and 13. Also was a member in 2014 of Rochester Mayor Warren's Early Learning Council. So is Jeff Smink. Jeff was on that council. He's an education-based consultant in Rochester who has done some educational lobbying in Washington, D.C. as well. Let me get back to the phones and Joe in Rochester. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, I am a Rochester City School District teacher myself, and I am on my way over to a CSE meeting in a moment. So I'll be able to catch a couple minutes here. And I heard Bill Calla mention the rate of passing, say tests go from 98% for one teacher, or 50% for one teacher, to 98% when he changed districts. And the amount of impact that has on our evaluation just seems so wrong, because really, a teacher doesn't change by going from one district to the next. And I thought that the responses from the panelists there seemed to really just dismiss the fact that the quality of the education at home is so different for students with active and engaged parents and educated parents who are aware of what a student needs to know to pass these exams. And what we're dealing with in Rochester is basically we get the kids for the amount of time that they're in school, and that's it. And they go home, and the amount of homework that's done that gets back to me is probably less than 2%. So I think that's a really, really tough thing to overcome. And for us to be evaluated based on that seems just flat out unfair.
All right, so Joe, hang on the line here. Let's let our panel respond. Jeff, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Sure. So I, you know, first of all, and this sort of gets at your question before the break, Evan, about what can, you know, what else can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I agree absolutely. There's no doubt that, you know, what happens outside of school matters, particularly in a place like Rochester. And so I think absolutely that's got to be addressed. And there, you know, there are things happening here in Rochester to do that. I, as you mentioned, I work in other communities where there's just some really innovative things focused on school readiness and developmental screenings and making sure that when kids do get to kindergarten, right, they're in a much better place than they are now. So again, I don't want to get at this either or situation. And I, you know, would never dismiss what happens outside of school, as the caller mentioned. I think it does matter. And I think you need to address both. But it's also, as Carrie mentioned, not an excuse, you know, when the kids are in school. You know, they're the kids that you've got. And as I said earlier, it is more challenging, and you're probably going to have to teach differently, you know, to reach some of these kids. But again, it's not an either or. You've got to do both. You've got to address what's happening inside and outside the school.
So I just want to jump in. First of all, I like to say that I was a teacher in, at a charter school in Chicago. So I definitely understand the struggles that teachers have to go through in order to educate kids, the amount of things that happen to them before they even walk into the classroom.
Right.
Many times they're not even in a mindset to learn right when they walk into
Absolutely.
The classroom. So I understand that. One of the things, and you know, I'm with the charter school, so I'm going to do the charter slant on it. But one of the things that charter schools are so successful is because they have the flexibility to innovate and make a lot of decisions and make a lot of decisions for the kids. And the people who are closest to the kids, that is the teachers, the principals, they're the ones who can make decisions about the kids. Where a lot of times what I heard from my public school counterparts were that, from my district counterparts, was that they didn't feel like they were in control of their classroom. They felt like they were just doing what people from the central office or, you know, wherever was telling them to do, and they didn't feel empowered. And so I think that's one of the things that why charter schools work is because you do empower the people who are closest to the kids. And I know for a lot of districts, they don't feel like that. And I think that's where a lot of that anger and backlash from the governor or whoever comes from.
Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I definitely get the feeling that what has to happen in my classroom is determined by outside of my classroom.
Absolutely.
And if we could sort of take some of that philosophy of openness to giving teachers the real power, to say, I know what's right for my kids, I know what's right for my students, and I'm going to go with this because this is going to be enriching to their educational lives, their educational adventures, and be beneficial to them. That would be great if we could take some of that philosophy, but we feel very rigidly fit into this one-size-fits-all style of education, so...
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like the style. I want it to be accessible to all the kids, though, not just the ones who have access to the charter schools.
At the end of the day, we're all on the same team. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Joe, thank you. Thank you for the call. Carrie, can you jump in as well? What do you think about some of his remarks there?
I agree. One thought is, you know, we need to, as taxpayers, school boards, we need to invest in teacher development, and teachers need the time and the resources to meet the needs, particularly of children living in poverty, to meet the demands of higher standards. So that takes an investment, and we haven't made that in a lot of districts, and we need to.
Okay. In Fairport, here's Natalie, and she's got a good question or a topic on how do you choose to define what is an effective teacher. Go ahead, Natalie.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a Fairport parent, and I'm very supportive of Dr. Calla, I have to say. And both my mother and my mother-in-law were both special ed teachers, and they'd be livid by what the governor has been saying, but about teachers. But I guess the question for me, since they were special ed teachers, is really what makes an effective teacher? You know, all I'm hearing about is test scores, and I think there's a lot more to being an effective teacher than just test scores. So I'd like to get, you know, a sense from your panelists, what makes a good teacher? It can't possibly just be those test scores.
Jeff?
And if it is, then we have a problem.
Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with the caller that it's not just about test scores and the way that the current structure is. I believe it's 20% of a teacher's evaluation. So, I mean, I think a good teacher is, whether it's for, you know, special education students or others, it's someone that can engage kids, keep them interested, you know, get across, And particularly, you know, also get across some of the basics, and particularly around reading and getting kids to read, you know, depending what grade you're working with. There's a lot of research around the importance of reading by the end of third grade. So I think, again, it's not an either or. You've got to have, you know, the test scores. And I would argue that if you have the engagement, you have a teacher that's really connecting with students, that you're going to see, you know, pretty good test scores, you know, from this at the same point, you're going to see more engaged kids and more engaged families. So I would agree with the caller. It's not everything. The test scores are not everything.
But I don't know anybody who's saying test scores should be 100%. And certainly nobody on this panel. But Natalie, but from what I'm seeing, again, the governor wants more of an emphasis on test scores. And again, I'm going back to, we want to make sure I have this right. He wants 50% of an evaluation would come from students' state test scores. And then 35% from independent observations, 15% from supervisor observations. So the governor could come back and say, nobody wants 100%, but maybe it should be roughly half. Too much, Natalie?
I think it is too much. And, you know, you can inspire in so many other ways, and your students still may not test well. They just may not be good standardized test takers. I'm not a good standardized test taker. I never was. But, you know, I'm a graduate of Smith College, and I'm went to law school. You know, I think I'm a pretty smart cookie, but I don't do well on standardized tests. And so, you know, I think that there's more to teaching and more to proving that a school is worthwhile and a teacher is worthwhile than if their students do well on tests that are these standardized tests rather than, you know, what they're doing in the classroom. They can do great in the classroom and have great grades, but they may not do well on one of those standardized tests. It's just a completely different thing. I mean, most people who take standardized tests that are for professional schools, most of them actually have to do a course, take a course on just on how to take those tests.
All right, let me ask, hold on.
It shows nothing about what their abilities really are.
Well, let me ask Carrie, because I don't want to make an assumption for Carrie, but I read your essay, your op-ed in the Democrat and Chronicle, and I get the sense that as a mom, for example, you have to measure you have to find metrics, and even with your own kids, sometimes test scores comes up. So do you accept the idea that some people don't do well on tests, that it's not a very effective measure, and that increasing test scores as a way we evaluate teachers is a potential negative, or do you say, look, there have to be yardsticks and, you know, life can be unfair sometimes? I mean, I know it's not always either or, but how do you answer that?
Yeah, it's not either or. A couple of points. This 50% isn't nailed down yet. The regions are actually saying they want it to be 40%.
Okay.
So, you know, it might not be 50 at all. The other point I think is important, that the test scores, it's not an absolute, it's growth, right? So wherever your child is, you know, that's the whole point of education, right, is you're moving your learning. So keep that in mind. The other thing I would say is that the APPR, the law, the evaluation law, also has room for student and parent feedback as one of the multiple measures, which is, you know, absolutely not test scores, right? So this is an opportunity, should local districts want to include it in their agreement, to give parents and students a voice, and to be a check on the testing, the test prep culture that is, you know, bubbled up in some schools. So the evaluation does have multiple opportunities. It's not just testing, as Jeff mentioned, but it. I think the debate about teacher evaluation is ultimately a debate about local control, right? How much sort of, you know, before 2012. The evaluations were really 100% locally developed. So we had 700 different teacher evaluation tools across the state, right? The governor is saying we need to have more uniformity. There needs to be some standard across districts.
And by the way, what Carrie said, I think, on growth is important. Let me just make sure we pin down what this means, because again, the governor said 50% of a teacher's evaluation coming from student state test scores. Carrie pointing out that it might end up shaking out to around 40, but either way, it would be an increase from where we are now. Mm-hmm. And let's say you've got a student who is just getting by 1 year. He's passing, but barely. Then a year from now, that student becomes a C student. That would reflect positively, Carrie, based on the growth,
mm-hmm.
yes?
Yes.
Okay. So a student who is essentially not showing up or failing could become a D student in all subjects the next year and not be a drain on a teacher's score based on their evaluation. Yes?
Yes.
And that's the idea.
That's the idea.
Okay.
Right. And I think the big win for parents in the governor's proposal is that the additional local tests that were happening in some districts that were a result of the 20% local test, that would be eliminated. So we're actually reducing the number of tests. The weight of the state test is just increased. So the number of tests is less.
And before I jump back to the phones, Jeff, again, as someone who's been in many different places, Carrie's talking about local control being an issue on evaluations, mm-hmm. and the governor wants something more that reminds me, and I don't say this as a pejorative, I know people think it's a loaded term, but it reminds me of the discussion about Common Core, for example, saying mm-hmm. we do need a core set of standards to evaluate, mm-hmm. Which is essentially how the genesis of Common Core came about. Mm-hmm. Is there too much local control across the country when you look at evaluations? Do you think it's more effective when there's not 100% local control, when there are more uniform standards?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not an expert on teacher evaluation. So, but I think speaking more broadly, I mean, there's always going to be that tension in education in the United States, right? We're a local control country, and over the last, particularly the last 20 years, there's been much more of a push from both the federal level and the state level. And so there's going to be tension around that, and you're seeing that. You know, I think it started out when No Child Left Behind came on, and then Common Core, as you mentioned, is sort of the next phase of that. So, I mean, I think ideally there's got to be a little of both, right? I mean, local control is important. Absolutely. The people that are closest to the kids need to make a lot of those decisions. But, you know, at a certain point, and frankly, why we have a lot of these reforms is that some kids were not being adequately served. And there was a desire, you know, to really put some more accountability behind federal dollars and state dollars. And again, I just want to emphasize, it's not, you know, we hear about the corporate side of it, but, you know, people like the president are supportive of this, governors are supportive of this, mm-hmm. businesses are supportive of a lot of these policies. And again, it's focused on getting all kids doing better academically.
One more quick question before I jump back on the phones. A caller wanted to know, are these standards, again, on the corporate side, the big business side? This question I've seen come up a lot. I'll ask you guys what you think. A caller wants to know, are the standards tests made by big business with commercial interest in mind? For example, why do we need to see names of specific products like Dr. Pepper mentioned in standardized testing? Jeff?
Well, I don't know anything about that particular example, but so, I mean, there's a couple.
You suspicious that these tests are being formulated to benefit big business?
I'm not suspicious
okay.
of that, no.
Carrie?
No.
I'm not either, but I would say, you know, it's the duty of citizens and parents to be skeptical and to push back. And you know, these tests have to be legitimate and they have to have integrity. And one way to ensure that is to question and to, you know, insist on the scrutiny. So I don't have a problem with that at all.
Okay. Back to the phones. This is George in Rochester. Go ahead, George.
Evan, I just want to say, you know, I listen to your show all the time, so you do a good job.
Thanks.
And Carrie, I did read your op-ed, and you know, you're right on with it. To me, I think that in the midst of education reform, we need to make sure that we're putting children first. As everyone digs into their trenches, you know, with their own agenda and their items that they're not willing to sort of put on the table, you know, we have to put the children first. So that we know what's at stake. You know, we know what's at stake is the next 1 to 10 years, the 20 years of kids that are going to be now, children that are going to be growing up and are going to become our future employees, future CEOs, future doctors, nurses. So we want to make sure that, you know, we put the children first because sooner or later, these are going to be the people that are going to be taking care of the next wave of our population. That's all I wanted to say.
Thanks, George. Any reflection from the panel?
I agree.
You get a lot of nodding around the panel. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is that in terms of the public education system, especially in urban areas, one of the things that we have to keep stressing is there's got to be more education of teachers and also content in classrooms about different oppressions, and in this case, I would say racism and all of that. You know, have a history and the institutional racism should really be a critical piece of that process. The second thing I want to say, though, is in regard to program suggesting, one of the things that I think is not being talked about enough is some of the motivation for a lot of the things that have been talked about this afternoon have to do with privatization of systems. And there needs to be on WXXI and media, whatever, a panel, a full discussion of what privatization means, because a lot of the issues, the poverty issue, the why teachers, the different evaluation system, the local control issue, lots of issues should be approached by looking at it from that, why the governor wants 50%, the political issues. And I'm someone who's had, I've had experience with dealing with this issue on a number of public institutions. And I can tell you, it's amazing what you really find out when you look at it from that fundamental point of view. So I would really urge the next conversation we have on XXI is to have people come in who've had some experience with this and to talk about these issues and what privatization means in the education system and the public service system in general. It's a critical issue. The dots need to be put together, and frankly, some of the dots are out there, but they haven't been put together. So I really would urge an understanding of that problem or issue needs to be done in order to understand this issue. So thank you.
Bonnie, thanks for the call. Let me kick it over to Justin. I know you hear people talk about privatization. We mentioned it this hour. And so I want you to address that and then real briefly address Jim's question. He said, I don't think you've pushed back on charter schools enough. They can't even prove that they are more effective. So, 2 points. Bonnie's talking about privatization. Should we be concerned about privatization, or should we look more into that, Justin?
Yes, I think privatization. I mean, as Carrie said, I think these are all issues that we should all bring up. In regards to privatization to charter schools, especially the ones in Rochester that I work with every day, I see no privatization. I see no corporation coming in and profiting off of the Rochester City School District students or the charter school students. So that's not something that I see.
All right. So Jim is saying, push back a little, saying, hey, Justin says charter schools can do it better because X, Y, Z, but do we know that you're doing it better?
Yes. The State Department of Education releases the scores for all schools. Charter schools need to report just like every other district school, and they're on the website, and yes.
Okay. So the score, again, in other words, the scores are higher.
The scores are higher. So basically, from what we have, basically charter schools, at least for ELA in 2013-2014, they scored around 30% proficient, whereas the Rochester City School District scored 7% proficient. Once again, those are all, that's all data, and you can look at each individual school online at the State Department of Education's website.
All right, so let me wrap up with this here. In recent weeks, we've heard from retired Superintendent Howard Mafucci, Bill Calla, John Baines, many people saying, if you change nothing but poverty in districts, in public school districts in our region, you would see a remarkable improvement in Rochester, for example, in impoverished districts. If you started with poverty and did nothing else, that there would be near parity across school to school to school, and that's the big issue. That's the elephant in the room, that if you don't start there, we're missing it. Let me go around the panel and ask. I know that you might not agree exactly. So, Carrie, give me one more idea we can take with us. What do you think needs to happen?
I think a complement to the anti-poverty work that we're already doing in this community is has been proposed by the governor. It's called receivership, and it would allow for the conversion of failing schools to community schools. So we would be creating schools much like the U of R East deal, but for more children. Combination of rigorous academics, extended learning opportunities, and services that poor children need. So that would be my one thing. It's a complement to this poverty push.
And real quick on East Side, we're going to talk about that coming up. Very interesting partnership.
Right.
Is that too expensive as a model to be able to do elsewhere?
It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. That'll be interesting to see what happens there. Jeff?
I just come back to the point I made earlier that we need to do everything we can possibly do, both, again, inside the school, during the school day, and outside the school, whether that's during the summer, which is an issue I've worked on a lot, after school, before school, early childhood, all those things. So everything should be on the table, and I think that's the only way we're going to make progress.
Justin.
So I would say that, yes, poverty is the biggest issue concerning education in the city of Rochester. But that's the reality, and regardless of that, we need to figure out ways that we as schools can adjust the way we educate our kids in order to make sure that they can still lead a successful life. Yes, it is a drawback, but we as educators signed up for this. We knew what we were getting ourselves into, so let's figure out ways that we can make it better.
I want to thank you all for being here, and I will also say that having interviewed people across the spectrum of views here, I do think everyone wants what's best for kids, and we're going to continue the discussion going forward on this and many other subjects. So, Justin, thanks for taking the time. Carrie, nice to have you in studio. Look forward to the next one. And Jeff Smink, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Short break. We're going to meet some students who spent time with the Clintons in Miami earlier this month with the Clinton Global Initiative. We'll be right back.